Welcome to the Last Rush Hour podcast. I'm your host, Fred Pilot, author of the recently published ebook, Last Rush Hour, The Decentralization of Knowledge Work in the 21st Century. If you've ever wondered that someday soon you would no longer need to waste time commuting to and from the office and the rush hour would become a thing of the past, the ebook and this podcast are for you. Today, with modern information and communications technology, knowledge work, analyzing data, reading reports, writing and producing presentations, planning and strategizing, and collaborating with colleagues and clients can be done anywhere with a reliable internet connection and whenever one can think, communicate, and be creative and productive. Knowledge workers and their organizations have begun migrating out of the commute and office space. People are increasingly working somewhere all of the time in home offices or in their communities. Some organizations have gone fully virtual, operating without the major expense of dedicated office space. Each podcast will feature a conversation with a notable individual influencing and driving this major shift in how we work in the 21st century information economy. This episode's guest is Michael Scherer. He is president of the Broadband Planning Initiative. It's a nonprofit. It was founded to provide education to local and regional planners on workforce planning. He's a consultant to local governments and localities and organizations. He's also president and CEO of Strategic Networks, LLC, which develops multi-location network workforce deployment methodology as an advancement in remote workforce and teleworking. It's a network of community-based offices and network services that supports the use of a distributed workforce and distance learning. And the services that Strategic Office Networks offers include working with local community stakeholders through public-private partnerships, and those partnerships analyze, plan, provision, and manage distributed workforce networks to provide economies of scale and create a platform for rapid geographic expansion and inclusion of layered value-added services such as distance learning and telemedicine. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Frederick. I appreciate you asking me here.
Hey, just call me Fred. I just go by Frederick in print.
Okay. All right. We'll do that.
But basically, you know, you're talking about something that, and I mentioned you in my book, Last Rush Hour, The Decentralization of Knowledge Work in the 21st Century. You're talking about something actually that was described way back in 1973 by a guy named Jack Nillis, who talked about having distributed offices located in communities where people live. So this is really kind of an old idea, but it's being resurrected now that we have such robust information communications technology. It really didn't exist back in 1973 when Jack wrote that in his book, and we now are in a different place now. I mean, this was pre-internet when he wrote this. You're proposing moving work out of the central downtown out to a location, a shared office location that might be shared by any number of organizations in communities where people live.
You dropped out there a little bit, Frederick, but I certainly got enough of the conversation. You know, Jack Nillis wrote that paper in 1973. It was 4 years before I would get my graduate degree in telecommunications. In fact, one of my one of the students at the University of Colorado in that program had actually done his thesis on teleworking. So I have a long history, I guess, of knowing where that came from and where we've gone with it. And if I went back and actually reviewed it, diagrams in there, which, you know, so closely align with, I think, with this evolutionary path. For the time and the technologies, I think it was very groundbreaking. Where I think if we review it in light of today, the extension of his thinking is really to look at how do we look at coincident geographic areas where major employers are hiring people, and use the densities of those hirings in a way that gives us a more scalable and more permanent network of facilities across an extended metropolitan area.
And you also talk about at your website, which is PocketsNet, for those who are interested, it's PocketsNet.com, P-O-C-K-E-T-S-N-E-T.com. You talk about traffic congestion and how this will cut down on the commuting to a centralized downtown location, which does cause a lot of our traffic congestion. And Jack Nils also talked about that in 1970s in his book, 1973 book, same problem. Here we are, you know, dealing with the same issue more than four decades later.
Yeah, and specifically it was the trade-off in transportation and communications. And we've seen several, I think, benchmark recognitions of this. In 2001, the UN and World Bank published a report on surface air transportation. And they pointed out, or surface air pollution from transportation, and they pointed out that there are three forms of access that we're dealing with here. One is transportation, second is proximity, and the third is telecommunications. And they underscored 14 years ago that transportation was most costly and damaging, and that telecommunications was probably the least leveraged.
Yeah, you're talking about using a whole newly matured infrastructure as an alternative to transportation infrastructure to reduce the transportation impacts, a lot of negative in terms of the environment and in people's lives. It's really an interesting concept you have here.
Well, and I think today I've become more sensitized to this because I saw more than just the air pollution and transportation dimensions of this. When we faced 9/11, and that was that, we really need to consider not just sustainability, but unfortunately, survivability, given some of the geopolitical considerations that we live in today that perhaps weren't here 40 years ago. So. It's germane not just to creating sustainable communities and walkable communities and opening up avenues for part-time working parents, people with disabilities, and really making more jobs proximate to people. Brookings Institution had just published a report that today that as these metropolitan areas are growing, that people's proximities to job opportunities is in fact being reduced. So we're seeing the consequences of high growth and of course the concerns around security and responsiveness of people in a time of crisis.
It's pretty paradoxical thinking about, you know, most people think of urban centers, metro centers as concentrating population rather than dispersing it to jobs.
Well, and certainly, the immediate thought is, gee, if we put some of these centers out in the extended corridors of these major metropolitan areas, we can reduce some of the transportation challenges that we have. And is that by placing centers in the urban core for those people that live there and want to live in the city centers, it now offers them access to jobs to employers that perhaps have moved out into suburban or even extra-urban locations. So it's a two-way flow. It's a reposturing, if you will, of real estate around the needs of the people. As opposed to building a technology center, which really only services the people in that proximity.
Right, and I just discussed in my book, the reason we had all that centralized in a downtown location is because before the internet, before personal computers, that's where all the tools were that knowledge workers needed to do their jobs, was in that central location, the telephones, the typewriters, the copiers, and later on fax machines.
Right, and where cities had developed, hub and spoke types of transportation and mass transit to support those kind of growth patterns, they certainly have persisted in that direction. I used to live out in the Chicago area, and I really questioned the might of the city leaders in Chicago enticing United Airlines out of Elk Grove Village, Motorola out of Schaumburg, and AT&T out of Hoffman Estates, all along the Northwest Corridor, which actually displaces thousands and thousands of jobs down into an inner city area that requires commuting and now puts the kind of pressures on the highways where people are having to consider additional tolls just to thin out the traffic.
I don't know if you had a chance to read Bill Davidow's book, Overconnected. He talks about something that's interesting that I think might be reinforcing the the continued reliance on mobility and commuting, because he talks about how the automobile and the highways in the 1950s basically built this commuting style of going to work that we have today, that even though we're in the information age now, this was back well before the internet, 1940s, 1950s, right after World War II. He goes on as far as to say that we have now basically, because we've put so much into this drive to work, long distance commuting to work, where it used to be people lived closer to work prior to the automobile because they had to, I mean, in order to get there, that we basically have locked ourselves into this. Do you think that's a big part of the shift that we're trying to go through here?
Well, I do believe that there's a certain inertia of rest and trying to displace that with almost a social engineering kind of approach to how to redistribute access. It presents some challenges, but you know what we have today, and we have quite a few things. You talk about our parents' ages in the 50s when they would go to work for an employer, they'd buy a home with a 30-year mortgage, and they probably had a 30-year career path with that employer. So the demographics of moves and changes and growth patterns were more stable at that point. And of course, the employment cycles with any given employer, which meant a locational proximity, seemed to hold true for a long period of time. Today, those are not the elements we're dealing with today. So the pent up demand for a solution to get to work every day is one that, what I've tried to present are the same things that Jack did years ago, is that we have this tremendously disruptive and powerful set of infrastructure tools, and it really requires us to understand that its inherent characteristics is the distribution of information and the interconnection of people regardless of their geographic locations. And that gives us a great opportunity to look at access in a whole new way. But it does require us to start to think about how do we change these decades-old structures that we've had from our legacy industries.
In the distributed offices you're talking about in the communities, I think one of the things you mentioned in terms of their benefit is that not everybody has a home office location in their home where they can be productive, nor do they work well alone, where your distributed community office provides that. It provides some degree of a shared workplace, the collaboration that people say is very important, that we still have to have the real-time co-located collaboration at least some of the work week. And it provides the tech support. People have the computer support they need. And I think, are these all things that can build confidence for organizations to move more towards this model, since it's a more controlled environment than working in a home?
Yeah, I think so. And let me point out the approach of finding the appropriate densities at each of these centers is one that is pursued to try to bring to us a secure networking or intranet kind of architectures for these regional communities. So that's one aspect of the densities. But you're right. The other one is the preservation of the social and cultural identities that the organizations attempt to maintain, and certainly that individuals seek. So I really, when you dig down in the research, I don't see an intergenerational difference in the needs to congregate with like-minded, like-employed fellow employees. I think that the distributed technologies are so disruptive that the first signs of changes in these central business office models is in fact having to allow people, if you will, and that's the way we phrase it, to work from home or kind of anywhere. But now, as things like security and insider threats, the need for mentorship, supervision, oversight, and I think one that we haven't really talked about is the one about employee privacy. You know, I truly believe that it's extremely important that we recognize the potential to be invasive on a employee's use of computers and information beyond the workday. And it's something that a lot of people haven't talked about, but I think people are starting to understand is a potential misuse of the technologies.
Well, actually, there is a fair amount of buzz about that around the term work-life balance and when do you turn off your smartphone. I've been seeing quite a bit of chatter about that topic.
The need to me, given our you know, concerns, I mean, I guess everybody, and I've watched a lot of the testimonies in various hearings in Congress in both the House and Senate committees and subcommittees, and you know, our best people are saying that we can expect some form of calamity, some kind of disruption in our cities, somewhere in the country. And these may be man-made, these may be acts of nature, but from different areas, I think the same call is there, is that we need to get prepared. And so to me, deployment is, you know, taking from a military strategy. This is a methodology to prepare the home front to have a higher level of situational awareness and the ability to respond immediately when an emergency happens, as opposed to perhaps rely on evacuation and in the hopes that people can get home, that they have power, that their telecommunication services are still operative and so forth.
Yeah, you talked, I think you did some work. Can you talk a little bit about your work in the D.C. area? Because certainly continuity of government is an important concern there in the nation's capital. Can you talk a little bit about what you've done trying to get this idea out to the federal government in the D.C. area, which has thousands of employees there?
Well, yeah. In fact, the last numbers I saw for the net population change during the day in D.C. proper was 425,000 people. And if you know the topology of the landscape out there, it's connected Maryland and Northern Virginia and D.C. through a number of tunnels and bridges. Systems, and it creates a real concern, or it should, that should some of those access routes be encumbered or jeopardized, should some of those tightly employed locations become contaminated in some way or subject to some form of terrorism or even storm fronts. You know, how are we going to move people and respond at the same time? Because if people are in the way of a evacuation, that means that first responders are going to have a more difficult challenge getting to the places where their services are needed.
Yeah, I saw an item today, and I may have passed it on to you, that California state government suffers from a similar thing with Sacramento, which has the second highest flood risk of any metro area in the country, next to New Orleans. I mean, if it gets a flood, a 100-year flood, the federal the state government is basically paralyzed because it's so centralized there.
Right, and most of our planning around preparedness or actually responsiveness is a reactive set of measures. This is what we do if this or when this happens. You know, I guess call me a Boy Scout, but I think the be prepared or the Ben Franklin an ounce of prevention are things that we ought to take seriously. And so the deployment and the access of jobs locally to more people, I think, is a way to enrich more communities, create a better balance in life for a large number of employees, certainly present to the transportation management people a alternative traffic demand methodology that does not yet really exist in their planning. And this greatest concern I have is to just be proactively postured to respond.
Where do you see the what kind of interest are you getting at this level? Where do you see the interest coming from in terms of moving to this distributed workforce model?
Well, it's interesting because you know, a good number of people that I respect have have been encouraging along the way, and I respect both their positions and their capacities, but nobody seems to have yet figured out, okay, who can actually make this happen. And at this point, in working with some people in the federal government, we've come to believe that the best way to do that is to do the geographic distribution analysis of hiring patterns. Essentially, let's look at the methods of access that people are using to get to work every day, and what the coincident hiring patterns of these agencies and departments is, and start to get a real geospatial understanding of what might be involved to take this a step further. The irony is that, and I say this, and I don't mean this to be coy at all, but the information of commuter surveys, of greenhouse gas emissions, of OPM, 2 years now missing in their telework numbers, has really made it a challenge to try to say, well, let me help you with the aggregates, but I can't get the aggregate numbers. And I said the tongue-in-cheek piece because I truly believe that someone in China probably has all the addresses of people that work for the various organizations, and I would hate to think that I have to try to find a Chinese contact to find information that should be readily available to us.
Well, right. That's my thought exactly, is this information should already be available. It's just a question of implementing and moving into the distributed work settings, not looking at hiring data.
Well, and I think that part of the resistance, I mean, this is... we've written a draft proposal of how this could help meet cross-agency mission objectives. And the challenge in doing that is that while there are some very specific cross-agency mission objectives in the areas of sustainability and security and so forth, there is no cross-agency mission initiative group. You can't take this to one group and say, hey, this meets cross-agency objectives, let's see how we can pull this together. So it means we're all kind of learning as we go, what's this new world requiring of us, and how do we best come together to imagine a better use of all of these resources, not just relying on one set or another.
Right, and I imagine it also involves thinking beyond just the organization's interest, because commuting, as you know, has been primarily a burden borne by employees, not organizations.
Well, and ironically, the reverse is becoming true as well. The space for your office coming out of your house is now being borne by the employee and not by the organization. Real estate costs are an important element to the federal government, and they've taken on an approach called freeze the footprint, which I really don't object to. But what I object to is that the way it's being implemented is a agency-by-agency centralization of offices, rather than looking at, wait a minute, let's look at where we're hiring people from, because that's where the real valued real estate is located, and let's figure out how to use the real estate to support the people, rather than have the people have to serve where the location is.
Well, just to be clear, this is not an either-or alternative to telework from home, right? This is part of redistribution of knowledge work outside of a central area. Is that right?
Exactly. Exactly. The other thing about the federal government's practices, aside from having trouble just knowing who's teleworking when, is the relatively low level of performance. I mean, 15 years of telework legislation, the federal government's last reported numbers in 2013 for 2012 was that about 300 or 350,000 federal employees had teleworked. Now, that sounds like a lot, but the objective set by 2004 was supposed to be 800,000. So we're a decade behind that date, and we haven't even have attained about 30% of what we should have been. So and furthermore, when you look at the practice of it, of those 300 or 350,000 that did it in 2012, on any given day, there was only about 50 to 60,000 people that were. Now, this is out of a workforce of 2 million people. So I really always question, if you only have 60,000 people on Tuesday that are working remotely, and you don't know which 60,000 they are, can you really say that you have a a viable continuity of operations plan where this is part of that. So I think we can do better, and I think we need to do better, and I think that creating a more inclusive architecture for these other people that have been left.
Hello.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Did I drop off there, Brad?
You dropped out there. Yeah. All right. Let's bring it to a close. I want to go back to what Jack Nellis wrote back in 1973, and he said, "We are now at a decision point as a society." Keep again in mind again. This is in 1973, where we must decide whether the way of life made possible by the automobile, since the turn of the century, will or can continue, or if we should consider alternate or modified modes of working, communicating, and living. Do you think we're at that the same decision point again in 2015?
Absolutely. I mean, the drivers that are moving us in that direction, the force of the telecommunications technologies we have available today to disrupt and to transform is greater than it was then. And I think right now we really are at a point where we're finally saying we need to imagine a different way of approaching the problems.
Do you think we're getting close to a tipping point?
Well, I suspect we're already at the tipping point. I think we're just waiting for somebody to turn on the light and recognize that we're here. It's time.
Well, Michael, well, thank you for joining me on the podcast. I've been talking with Michael Scheer. He is president of the Broadband Planning Initiative and president and CEO of Strategic Office Networks, LLC. I will be putting up on the link to this podcast a link to his LinkedIn articles. He's written a number of articles in this area. Thank you again, Michael.
Brad, you have a great day. Thank you.